It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about a new study that says the salt we put on our roads is ending up in our lakes, and we'll find out what impact that has on these freshwater ecosystems.
First, in his proposed budget, President Trump would get rid of the Essential Air Service program, known as EAS. The program gives federal funding for commercial air service at small airports around the country, including two airports in Wisconsin, the Rhinelander-Oneida County Airport and the Chippewa Valley Regional Airport.
Barry Adams reported on the possible subsidy cut and how it would affect Wisconsinites. He's a regional reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
So tell us about this subsidy. What is it meant to do? How does it keep airports in business?
Well, in essence, commercial carriers would not be able to afford running commercial service out of these airports if it wasn't for the subsidy. So the subsidy is designed to help communities still have air service in areas where they feel that there could be a, if they don't have it, it would be a hardship on the communities and could lead to less business and less air travel, obviously.
And this would affect, you're right, the airport in Rhinelander and the Chippewa Valley Regional Airport in the Eau Claire area. You focused especially on the Rhinelander Airport. Can you talk about that airport? Paint us a picture and tell us what role it plays in the community.
Yeah, this story was first reported probably about a month ago when President Trump unveiled his budget. And we were going to Park Falls for a story on St. Croix Rod, the fishing rod manufacturer. And we said, well, since we're up there, let's go over to Rhinelander and let's kind of see what this airport looks like and who uses this airport and what this airport means to the Hodei capital of the world. So, we go over to Rhinelander. This is a week and a half ago. And, it's very quaint. It's nothing like you would see in Madison, 25 cents an hour for short-term parking. It's $6 a day for long-term parking. In fact, when you do short-term parking, you plug a meter. There's no restaurant in this airport terminal that was built in 1979. There's three vending machines. If you want any food to take on your flight, you can buy it from a vending machine. So you get your choice of Coke and Pepsi products and some candy bars and potato chips, basically. And then there's also a vending machine for dollar cups of coffee. John Heisman is not from Rhinelander, but visited Rhinelander frequently. The football great. His bust is in the terminal as well. And if you want earplugs, you have to purchase it from a gumball machine. They're like in these little bubble, those little plastic bubbles like you would buy prizes in, and you purchase those for 50 cents out of a gumball machine. We were kind of surprised. We were there. We had gotten into Rhinelander the night before. We woke up early on, I guess it was Thursday morning when we were up there, and we got there about 5:45, and there was very few people there for a 7 o'clock flight. In fact, there was basically more TSA agents than there were passengers there, and there was five TSA agents there at the time. And overall, it was just a flight. They only have 50-seat planes that come into this airport. And there was about 20 passengers who boarded at that time. So it's very, if you think getting in and out of Madison is quick, this is even a lot quicker. I mean, there's really no security lines for the most part. It's pretty hassle-free. You're literally 100 feet from the TSA line to your car that's parked out in the parking lot.
It's small, but you talk to some people at the airport and in the community who say it actually is important to the economy and to people who want to run a business there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's people from all over northeastern Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan who use this airport in Rhinelander. And we should also mention, too, that the UP also has small airports that have commercial service and that are also on this EAS list that could be cut as well, including Iron Mountain and Ironwood Hurley Airport. So if they were to lose theirs, if Rhinelander were to use their service, the only options in northern Wisconsin would be Central Wisconsin Airport in Mosinee, and then you'd have to go to Marquette out of the old KISRI Air Force Base to catch a flight. And then, of course, you also got Green Bay and Appleton as well.
Talking to Barry Adams from the Wisconsin State Journal about smaller airports in Wisconsin that are at risk because of proposed cuts in the president's budget to essential air service subsidies, in effect, to keep these open. And yeah, let's talk about there would be an airport desert, really, in northern Wisconsin. The furthest north in Wisconsin, as you say, would be the central Wisconsin airport and Wausau area, and then the Green Bay airport. Is there a sense of, apart from the economic side of this, the intangible idea of isolation if these airports go away?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like one of the people I talked to said, you know, we're fairly isolated the way it is. You know, when you talk to people about what it takes to get to a certain place, it can be an arduous trip. I mean, we had one couple that drove from Iron River, Michigan to Rhinelander. Then they were taking that flight to Minneapolis, and then Minneapolis to Dallas, I believe. So, you know, it's not crazy, the trips, but again, they are fairly isolated in that part of the state, and so it would be an inconvenience for a lot of people. And, you know, we talk about the economics, and, you know, for business, you know, there's a $300 million expansion of PrintPak up there that was, you know, the airport was instrumental for them to consider putting that plant there in Rhinelander as opposed to moving it to North Carolina. And there was another company as well that makes paper backing for carbon fiber. And so there's some industry there that relies on this airport. And it's a pretty vital part of the community. You know, you also have to remember, too, that Rhinelander is a very heavy tourist area. And so every year there's thousands of people who come into that airport for the summer. There's people that come in the wintertime. They'll fly into Rhinelander to go to the snowmobile races in Eagle River. So it's heavily used year-round.
You talked to the manager of that airport in Rhinelander. Oh, what did he have to say about all this?
Yeah, you know, Joe Brower, he's a Republican, and he's been there since 1990. He voted for Trump, and he thinks that even if these cuts happen, he thinks that it wouldn't. He thinks air service might continue. Now, that's not a guarantee, but he feels confident that they might have enough business there that would continue the service for the airport. Right now, there's two flights a day out, you know, in and out of the airport. Same with the Chippewa Valley and Miro Claire. They've got two flights. Their flights are going to Chicago. Rhinelander goes to Minneapolis.
But with the economics of air travel, as you say, that's not a guarantee. It might not be worthwhile for the air carriers to keep that up without the subsidy, it sounds like.
Right. And that's something that, you know, the market, I guess, would have to determine whether or not they felt it was profitable. Joe Brower, though, thinks that maybe there could be enough for even three flights a day out of Rhinelander.
Now, has there been a response to this politically in northern Wisconsin since this budget proposal came out?
Well, you know, I mean, you got to remember, this is a very heavily Republican area of the state. You know, Vilas County nearby voted 60-35 for Trump. Oneida County, 56-37. And Florence County, the most Republican county in the state, based on the presidential election, they voted 71-25% for Trump over Hillary Clinton. So, you know, these are Trump voters up there, and they could lose a pretty valuable service. But, you know, some feel that, you know, maybe it does need to go, and people need to sacrifice if they want to truly cut the budget.
Barry, we shared your piece on Facebook, and Eric wrote there, good luck getting businesses to come there to Rhinelander when they have to fly into Green Bay, rent a car, drive there, and then drive back to Green Bay. Airports, he writes, keep small cities alive. That's why the government picks up the tab. Is that the worry in the area, that a business might think twice about going there if they can't have that airport option?
Yeah, I think that's one of the concerns, and among others. So, yeah, I think that concern is definitely there. You know, but you also have to remember, you know, there was a time in this state where there were a lot more airports that had commercial air service. Sheboygan, Manitowoc, Marshfield, Wausau, they all had commercial service at one time, and that's no longer the case. So, you know, things change, and it is a concern about what kind of an impact losing that service would have on a community.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
That's Barry Adams, regional reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about how President Trump's proposed budget could put two regional airports in Wisconsin at risk of shutdown. You could find, again, a link to his piece on the Central Time Facebook page. as soon as the snow starts falling later this year in Wisconsin, you're sure to see the roads and sidewalks peppered with salt. But we're now learning there may be an environmental cost to using salt as our main de-icing agent.
Hillary Dugan joins us now. She's a researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Limnology, and she co-authored a recent study that shows road salt is increasingly finding its way into our lakes. Hillary, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us first about this study? What were you looking to get a handle on?
Yeah, so it's been, we've known for a long time that it's been an environmental concern that road salt is going to run off into our fresh waters, be that streams, lakes, groundwater. What was unique about our study was that we looked at a really large geographical extent spanning the U.S. Midwest all the way to the Northeast and found that a lot of lakes across this entire region were increasing in chloride over sort of a decadal time period.
And chloride is?
Chloride is sort of one half of road salt. So once road salt hits water, it dissolves into both sodium and chloride. And so we track chloride trends through time.
And how did you get a handle on that, about finding out over the decades? Because I can't imagine that this was something that would have been tracked super specifically if you go back 20, 30, 40 years.
So getting our hands on long-term data was the most difficult aspect of the study. We're lucky here in Wisconsin that there's the university itself and the Department of Natural Resources has done a really great job tracking some of these environmental contaminants over time. And so we can see that long-term change.
And one of the things that matters when you're looking at these lakes and bodies of waters is the surfaces that surround them. And the term in the study is impervious. Are there impervious surfaces around the lake?
Right.
Can you describe what that is and what that might look like?
Yeah, so an impervious surface is anything that water is not going to get through. So that's usually roads or parking lots that we're talking about. And what we found was that any lake that had as little as 1% impervious surface around its shoreline was really at risk for these long-term chloride trends.
So that's not a very high percentage, 1%.
Very low. Yeah, so if you see a lake that has a road running alongside it, so basically if you can drive by a lake, it's probably getting road salt runoff if you're in a region of the country that's applying road salt.
So if we're looking at Wisconsin, how many lakes are we talking about that have, you know, roads around them that are going to see that kind of runoff?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, we only actually had 11 lakes in our data set with long-term data, but we know that there's, you know, tens of thousands of lakes in this state. And we can do that calculation of how many lakes have roads along them. And it's upwards of 30% in some areas. And so a lot of lakes are at risk for these long-term changes.
And you were getting at the scale of this, a large-scale, long-term study. Can you talk about the importance of long-term data collection on how the UW fits into this big picture?
Yeah, so long-term data collection is incredibly important. I mean, we wouldn't know about these changes if we didn't know that the baseline concentrations were a lot different than what they are today. And it also allows us to track how well our changing practices are going to sort of help remediate these lakes. So as we become more knowledgeable about the environmental impacts, we've started to change how we apply road salt. Cities and municipalities and states have done a really great job at trying to improve how they lay down road salt. And with long-term data, we'll be able to see the effect of that and know, you know, what we're doing is working.
So you found that when there were these impervious surfaces around the lakes, that the salinity, it goes up. So what does that mean for the lakes themselves?
Yeah, I think there's two main components. The first is that a lot of lakes are used as drinking water sources. So at a certain point in time, we're going to be able to start tasting the salt, which is pretty unpleasant. And it's incredibly expensive to remove salt from water. Almost no drinking water plants are set up to do that. And so in Madison, for instance, we're having a problem with chloride levels in our groundwater. And at a certain point, you just have to stop using those wells if, you know, if they keep rising. The second point is that chloride affects aquatic species living in lakes. And so you might start seeing changes in algae that are adapted to more salty conditions. And that has ramifications through the food web.
And what about the density of the life that's in the lake? Does that get affected too?
Yeah, it definitely has an impact on biodiversity, and so you might just start seeing the loss of species over time. And what we're worried about is that as you increase salinity, you might leave these habitats more favorable for invasive species and sort of giving a leg up to exotic species.
Can you give us a sense of the levels of salinity that you found in various lakes? I know the study in specific mentioned a lake that I've canoed on, Lake Wingra, and I thought the level was surprising there. What else did you see here in Wisconsin and beyond?
Yes, so Lake Wingra is a great example. It's a pretty shallow lake, and the baseline concentrations of lakes around the Madison area probably should be about 1 to 2 milligrams per liter. And Winger is now over 100, so it's increased 100 times in its salinity of what it should be. Lake Mendota is another example, but it's a much deeper lake, and so it's increased about 50 times what it was. So it really depends on the lake depth. You can imagine that sort of the bigger the lake, the more buffered it might be from some of these contaminants. But even the Great Lakes are seeing increases in chloride from road salt, which is pretty amazing given the volume of those lakes.
And what about the rest of the lakes that you surveyed? Because this was this big scope here from mm-hmm. lakes in Wisconsin all the way over to the Northeast. How did the rest of the lakes fare?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely dependent on size. I think Wisconsin, we're lucky because we have a lot of big lakes in the state, and a lot of lakes in the northern half are pretty remote. But in areas in the Northeast that are really urban, almost all of the small lakes were in danger of sort of these long-term trends. The Twin Cities is another good example. So in Minnesota, where there's a lot of small lakes right in the city, and almost all of those have much higher concentrations than we're seeing here in Madison.
Hillary Dugan is with us now, researcher at the UW-Madison Center for Limnology, and we're talking about a recent study that she co-authored showing that road salt is increasing the salinity of our freshwater lakes. And so when we have this information in our back pocket now, what do we do with it? How do we make a change?
Yeah, I think we need to be more cognizant of how we apply road salt. And so for the most part, we think of road salt being put down by cities, and cities are aware that this is an environmental concern, and they're trying to balance public safety with the environment, but also their budgets. So, you know, if they're going out and there's ways to use less road salt, they're going to be all for that because it saves them money in the long run. I mean, we spend, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the state just on road salt. But what I think people aren't really appreciating is just how much road salt's put down by private citizens and businesses. So people clearing their own sidewalks or businesses clearing parking lots. And these are often contracted out. And that's where you see sort of piles of road salt lying around. And you have to be aware that really you only need a sort of a handful of road salt to effectively melt ice on, you know, a square meter of sidewalk. And so if you see a pile of salt laying around, that's definitely too much salt. And so just on a sort of person-to-person basis, have to be more aware of how we apply this privately.
Is there any sort of environmental threshold that we say if a lake goes above this, it's too much and we need to dial it down?
Yes.
What's the top limit?
So there's different thresholds. So the EPA considers a chloride threshold of 230 milligrams per liter. So to put that in perspective, that's about 1 teaspoon of salt in a 5-gallon bucket. So it's very little salt to pollute this water.
So do you think that there's some kind of regulation needed, or does it happen at the civic level, where, as you said, we start to become more aware as citizens and as communities that we need to maybe dial it back a little?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have to be aware that, you know, we live in a state that has pretty harsh winters and have to be cognizant that we're going to have to deal with snow, and maybe, you know, instead of throwing down a lot of road salt, we might just, you know, drive more slowly during those months. But there are states that are looking into making citizens less liable for accidents that might take place on their property. And so right now, a lot of private contractors, you know, throw down extra road salt because it's cheaper than being sued. And some states, New Hampshire is a good example, that's becoming aware of this problem and trying to reduce the liability on citizens. Therefore, they might, you know, use less road salt as a result.
And I'm sure you've heard about this, too. We've heard about cheese brine mm-hmm. being used to melt ice instead of salt. I understand sometimes there might be an odor associated. I've never smelled it or experienced it. But what about that? Is that an alternative that we should be putting more resources into?
It's a great Wisconsin alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So cheese brine, I mean, some of these brine ideas are great, but they don't solve the problem of chloride runoff into lakes. So a lot of brines are made of chloride. It's just that cheese brine might be a free alternative, whereas you're not going out and buying road salt. So if cheese brine is dumped down the drain, it's going to end up in our lakes. We might as well put it on roads first, and then it's going to end up in the lakes. So trying to come up with alternatives that might not use as much salt in general, sort of better solutions.
Got a comment here from Rod on Facebook who wants to know, what is the effect on lakes from treated water from waste treatment that contains water softener salt?
Yeah, so water softener salt is definitely a large proportion of some of the chloride input into lakes. And Madison's a great example where there's a lot of private water softener use. And so that's going to have the exact same effect. Wastewater treatment plants can't remove salt from water. It's just too costly. And so if the lakes downstream from those water treatment plants are definitely going to have elevated chloride.
You said before that it was very laborious, maybe costly to remove salt from lakes. What is that process?
You're going to have to ask an engineer on that one. But if you think about desalinization of ocean water, I mean, it's sort of a last resort when it comes to trying to create fresh water.
So it's not ideal to fix it from that end. You're saying let's get fixing it on the other end of the problem.
Yeah. So we just have to be cognizant of what we're putting down on the roads is it's going to end up in the water. And it might be, you know, this year, it might be decades from now. A lot of what we put down is actually stored in soils. So there's been some studies that have said that, you know, 70% of road salt that's put down on roads is actually stored in the soils nearby, and 30% of that runs off into lakes right away. And so even if we stopped applying road salt now, we probably wouldn't see the benefit of that for a few years, maybe a decade, before we really flush all that legacy salt out of the soil. So we've been salting roads since the 1940s, and so there's a lot of salt buildup in the environment. So, you know, part of that long-term monitoring is important because, we need to see when we're going to start seeing those results.
This is probably more of an engineering solution, but are there any sort of ideas that do come more from road design? For example, a grade of a road maybe tilts away from a lake instead of toward.
Yeah, and just, you know, how far away it is in general. So the bigger the buffer, the less impact you're going to have right away. I mean, again, you're going to store that salt in the soils, but it's not going to create, you know, really flashy inputs of chloride, say, during snowmelt.
So what's your takeaway? A lot of public citizens listening to this realizing it's not just city use. What do you want people to know as someone who studies this?
Yeah, I mean, I want people to know that there's a lot of work going on in this. You know, the city of Madison and other cities in Wisconsin and the state are well aware. There's a great resource that's been put together called Wisconsin Saltwise. So it's wisaltwise.com. And it has tons of resources on, you know, how salt's affecting both our drinking water and our environment and what you can do to sort of help.
Terrific. Hillary, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Hillary Dugan, researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Limnology, talking about a recent study that she co-authored showing that road salt is increasing the salinity of our freshwater lakes and getting some ideas there about what to do about it.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
We take a look at the heroes of science now with Gemma Tarlak. From household names to forgotten figures and unsung heroes, Discover Magazine profiled some of the biggest contributors to scientific discovery in their May issue.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Who do you think are the biggest heroes in science? What about the lesser known names? And what scientific contributions do you think are the most important in your book? What discoveries do you think maybe deserve more attention? Call with your nominations at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Gemma Tarlak is with us now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and happy science to you both.
And to you. Well, we'll get into some of the maybe not so big names. Let's start with sort of a hypothetical Mount Rushmore of science that you talked about at Discover. Who makes the cut?
Well, obviously, you've got to put Einstein on there. I mean, you know, fair enough, right? He's the only household physicist, only physicist with a household name. And obviously, Marie Curie, Isaac Newton, and Charles Darwin. You know, it was kind of hard picking only four people, but keeping to the Rushmore idea, those were the four we went with.
My sense is that of those four, that Marie Curie has gotten more attention as the years go on. Do you think that science is starting to uncover some of these women contributors and give them more of their due?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I would argue Marie kind of got her due. Her career was unfortunately cut short, probably by her career. Most of us know that she probably perished from exposure throughout her career to extreme radiation. But, you know, she is the first woman to win a Nobel, and she is the only person to win Nobels in two different sciences. So I think a lot of people are pretty familiar with, if not the details of her, with just the fact that she is a true giant in science. And I think more and more, as science itself becomes more diverse, we're hearing more and more about the scientists who were not, you know, Victorian-era guys who made a difference.
And you also write about Albert Einstein, kind of a rock star. He started the first, or he was the cause of the first, how did you put it, the first science riot? And he wasn't even there?
And it's actually, I got to give props to the Chicago Tribune. They were the ones who called it the first science riot in history. But in 1930, there was a film, not even Einstein, you know, present, as you mentioned, but they were just showing a film about Einstein and his general theory of relativity, and way more people showed up than they had room for, and people were, you know, like knocking down the doors and shoving and trampling and everything. So it was a science mob for sure.
Now let's talk a little bit about Sir Isaac Newton. I hadn't realized he was such a colorful character, although I think he's the one that you write that he was generally regarded as being very unpleasant to be around. And he lectured to nobody. He just wanted to be in lecture mode. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, you know, my colleague Bill Andrews wrote all about Isaac Newton, who's kind of one of his personal heroes, but I must say that Bill is far more pleasant to be around. But yeah, Isaac Newton, you know, he did not take criticism well. He didn't really have any friends. He was just kind of his own, kind of like Batman, you know, his own superhero, doing his thing, not really wanting help from anybody else. But yeah, he would show up to give a lecture when he was at Cambridge, and if no student showed up, didn't matter, he still gave the lecture. He didn't do anything halfway.
Much like my band, we'll play even if nobody shows up. And then kind of a different personality to round out the four, Charles Darwin, mild-mannered guy, not the sort of person you necessarily expect to have this earth-shaking discovery.
Yeah, you know, Darwin was, he was a family guy. He was just kind of this enthusiast for nature. And then when he went on this five-year trip around the world, fortunately, he was such a gifted observer, and I might say that is a thread that runs through all of our heroes of science. They're really called out as gifted observers. And Darwin in particular really started noticing, hey, I'm seeing as I go from one coast to another on this great voyage, I'm seeing these strange similarities. And he put it all together during this five-year trip when he was in his 20s, but he actually waited another 20 years to gather even more information and build a stronger case and make sure that he was sure of it before he went public with his theories.
And Gemma, there was a surprising connection between two of the people on your list, Charles Darwin, we just talked about, but also Francis Beaufort. What was the connection?
Yeah, you know, Francis Beaufort is one of our unsung heroes. We singled out about eight of them, and Beaufort did a lot for science, and he's a fascinating figure in and of itself, but one of my favorite things about him is that in 1831, Captain Robert Fitzroy said, hey, I'm going to go survey the coasts of South America. Of course, he didn't sound like that because he was British, so he sounded much more elegant, but anyway, he said, hey, I'm going to go sail around South America. Can you recommend someone to come with me, someone who, you know, would basically be a good companion for the voyage? And Beaufort says, why don't you take this guy? His name is Charles Darwin. And the ship was, of course, the Beagle. And, huh. You know, history was written. So,
and Beaufort himself known for lots of stuff, right?
Yeah, well, he's, of course, known for the Beaufort scale, and that's how we classify wind force. He also developed a system of notation for the weather, and he really made understanding the weather a top priority. He also made hydrography a top priority in terms of understanding the coastline, understanding where you don't want to put your ship or your boat. And probably this came from the fact that when he was 13 years old, he was in the British Royal Navy on his very first voyage with the Navy to China. The ship foundered because they hit some rocks, ship went down, and he and the rest of the crew spent 5 days on the open water before being rescued. So I think that has something to do with him really being conscious of weather conditions and just the coasts and where, again, not to put your ship.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, talking about heroes of science, both sung heroes and unsung heroes. And Gemma, one that surprised me was that there was a single creator of the scientific method. I sort of assumed that this had evolved with many contributors, but not so.
Yeah, and it actually goes all the way back to the mid-10th century. In what's now Iraq, this incredible, incredible mind. English speakers know him basically as Alhazen. I am not going to attempt his name because it is very long and I will embarrass myself, but let's just call him Alhazen. And he wrote more than 100 books on physics, on mathematics, on astronomy. And he was actually the first one to explain why when we look at the moon in the sky, if it's down near the horizon, it looks so much bigger than when it's way above us, even though the size doesn't actually change. He was the first that we know of to figure this out, why why this illusion happens. But he also, he was really into testing. He wanted to test results. And he also felt it was very important to question any scientist who had gone before him, to question those conclusions, see if you could kind of pick them apart. And that's really the heart of the scientific method. You observe, you hypothesize, you experiment, you tweak your hypothesis, you tweak those experiments, and you repeat, and you're always questioning, always trying to pick apart your conclusions to see if you can improve them. And he was really the first one that we know of, that we have records of, who said, yeah, this is how you've got to do it. You can't accept the status quo. You always have to be, as he put it, making yourself an opponent of everything that has been written before, and trying to find that weak spot and pick it apart.
Well, turning to another unsung hero, I know you're a big fan of dinosaurs, Gemma, and fossils. And you've talked to us, I think, before about Mary Anning. She found lots of fossils, and a lot of those fossils ended up being named after the men who bought the fossils from Mary Anning.
Yeah, and not just named after them, but, you know, when you donate a fossil to a museum collection, say, the name that's recorded is the guy who owned the fossil. And Mary Anning, you know, one of the things I love about her is I'm a huge Jane Austen fan, and I like to think of the same time that, you know, the Bennet sisters were running around looking for husbands, Mary Anning was out there with a pick and a shovel clinging to a sea cliff, just like, I'm going to get this bone, you know? And that's what she did. She hunted for fossils. And she sold them to enthusiasts, to collectors, to scientists. And she wasn't just someone who, like, found stuff and sold it, though. She really had an incredible understanding of the anatomy of these animals. And so she really kind of helped out unofficially on a lot of the scientific research, but was very rarely credited.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Justin joining us in Sauk City. Justin, hi.
Hey.
Who did you want to nominate?
Hey, I wanted to nominate J. Fraser Stoddart, who won a 2016 Nobel Prize in Chemistry, won that for discovering the mechanical bond, which is a completely new type of, I guess, chemical bond. One of the only, I would say there's maybe three or four stretching the definition of chemical bond in existence, and he discovered one along with Ben Feringa and Jean-Pierre Sauvage.
Terrific.
Very
Justin.
Cool.
Thank you. Those are not specifically discoveries that were on my radar, but it's important to remember that every piece of knowledge helps, and these are big contributions to the scientific world. Gemma, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, the one thing, I kind of wish that we had recorded our meetings about who to put in this Heroes of Science issue, because I won't say it was knockdown, drag out, brawling, but people felt really passionate about it. And the wonderful thing about science is that there are so many people out there just absolutely devoting their lives to it who are doing this great work. And, you know, they're not household names. They're not Einsteins, but their contributions are just as important. So thanks, Justin, for cluing us into another one.
Justin, thanks a lot. As we talk to Gemma Tarlach from Discover Magazine, talking about Heroes of Science.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who stands out to you in the world of science? If you are in the sciences yourself, is there somebody who inspired you, your role model in the science world? Who should be at the top of our minds who maybe isn't when it comes to science? What are the biggest discoveries, the most important ones? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're getting back to our discussion now with Gemma Tarlach of Discover Magazine, talking about heroes and unsung heroes of science.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. There's the big names, the Einsteins, the Curies, the Newtons, the Darwins. What about the names that aren't as well known? Is there an unsung scientific hero that you wish people knew more about? If you teach or work in the sciences, is there a scientific name that's captured your attention? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Jim, I want to talk about one of the inclusions on your list that would definitely have counted as unsung until very recently, and that name is Henrietta Lacks. And we have a clip. This is actually becoming a feature starring Oprah Winfrey as the daughter of Henrietta Lacks. Here it is.
For years, it seemed like a dream. About our mother, could this be true? you don't understand is we didn't know nothing about nothing.
Scientists had been trying to get cells to grow outside of the human body, but they would always die. Until Henrietta's cells came along.
Henrietta's cells came along, became known as HeLa cells. Gemma, tell us about Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah, and you know, we have her in our unsung heroes for a couple of reasons. Number one, as you kind of heard in the clip, she was the first person who's contributed cells to cell lines that actually they survived and they were used in literally tens of thousands of experiments. But at the same time, you know, these cells were just taken without her knowledge, without her consent, without her family. No one knew. The researcher just took the cells and went on to make them, I would say, one of the key elements in experiments for a lot of different fields. And there was never really any acknowledgement, recognition of her incredible contribution to advancing our understanding in cancer, in biology, in so many different ways. And so it was really in 2010 when Rebecca Skloot wrote The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks that it brought her story out to the public. But you know, even after that, like in 2013, researchers published the HeLa genome with personal information, personal genetic information that, you know, it was Lacks genetic history, and it was also that of her descendants without, you know, any concern for privacy. And so we shed a light on Henrietta Lacks and acknowledge her as one of the unsung heroes of science, in part just for her incredible contribution, which she never even knew she made this incredible contribution. She died at only 31 from cervical cancer. But at the same time, you know, there are other people out there. Before science really wised up to understanding consent and protecting privacy, there are other people out there who have made similar contributions that we'll never know their names, probably. So we wanted to spotlight Henrietta, absolutely, and also remind readers that she wasn't the only sort of pioneer without even knowing it to really advance our understanding and help us make this world that we have today.
Go back to our callers now as we talk about heroes of science, well-known or unsung, with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. Elizabeth is with us in Fish Creek. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. Lynn Margulis, who is strangely absent from our study of biology, who first really described and identified symbiogenesis, which is crucial. It's the engine of creation in evolution. And instead, we still speak so much about Darwinian evolution, which really just describes the engine of elimination. And so for some strange reason, you know, this is a woman who is mocked, derided, lost her chair as a professor when she came forth with her theories. And then when we developed the ability to do genomic mapping, darn it, that old crazy Lynn was right. So for some reason, she's ignored, which drives me batty.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Gemma, is this a common story as you look at unsung heroes in science?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the universal things we found, sort of all of our heroes of science, really, again, gifted observers, that was particularly notable about them. But we found with our unsung heroes, and even some of the not-so-unsung heroes, they were up against the establishment, up against conventional thinking. A lot of them were, again, mocked and derided, as our caller Elizabeth mentioned. They were set, you know, told, you're crazy, it'll never work, you're nuts. And it turns out that, yeah, they were on to something.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Jim calling from Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, I'd like to acknowledge two often unknown giants, Professors Crick and Watson. Crick from Cambridge University, Watson from Trinity College, Dublin, who discovered this little-known thing is known as the human genome and DNA, which may have ramifications for centuries to come.
Jim, thank you for that. And Gemma, you will, I think, see Jim, his Crick and Watson, also raise them and another contributor there.
Yeah, and in fact, we do mention Crick and Watson's contributions, but we also mention the contributions even more often overlooked of Rosalind Franklin, who Crick and Watson's discoveries would not have been possible without her, and she was really passed over in terms of recognition. And unfortunately, she passed away in the prime of her career, very young, and so she never she was not around to really enjoy the recognition when it finally came her way years later.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Molly on the line in Milwaukee. Molly, hi.
Hi. I'd like to nominate a whole entire profession of unsung heroes in healthcare known as medical laboratory professionals. These would be our medical laboratory scientists, histotechnologists, phlebotomists, pathologists, actually National Medical Laboratory Professional Week. And this is a whole area of healthcare where they're providing test results to give information about the diagnosis and treatment about more over 70% of laboratory or healthcare decisions out there. So the whole profession in general.
Molly, thanks for the call. And Gemma, that's a lot of science isn't the lone genius, coming up with the eureka moment. It's a lot of people doing little bits and pieces and having it build up over time.
Absolutely. And you know, a lot of the times, a lot of the big discoveries may get attached to a specific scientist's name. But when you dig a little deeper, you find that, oh, that person was actually the head of a lab. And in that lab, there were 20, 30, 40 sort of unsung heroes. And yeah, absolutely right. They were preparing the slides. They were reviewing the data. They were inputting the data, just doing all of the work that absolutely has to be done and is absolutely unglamorous. So absolutely tip of the hat to them.
And Jem, I want to read about a comment from our Central Time Facebook page, a local hero of science that came up there. Fran Hammerstrom, someone writes about a naturalist, ornithologist, and writer in Wisconsin, lived from 1908 to 1998 and was the only woman to study wildlife under Aldo Leopold. And her legacy lives on in over 100 publications, 10 books, and in the trails she blazed for women in wildlife biology. I know you have John Muir included as part of your list. What about Fran Hammerstrom?
Unfortunately, we don't have her. We do have Aldo Leopold as one of the great sort of explainers, one of the scientists who did not just do research, but also got that research out in the public eye. And I love learning about more of these scientists. Again, we had a tough time narrowing down what would fit in the pages we have for this story.
And Gemma, we're just about out of time. You got to share one of your favorites, though, Marie Tharp.
Yes, I absolutely love Marie Tharp. She was a geologist and a cartographer. She passed away in 2006, but not before she really kind of wrote the map on what we think of the ocean floor. She was not allowed on the research vessels. She had to work from her lab, from her desk, but crunching the data, she figured out this incredibly rich landscape at the bottom of our oceans. And in mapping it out, she also noticed the first signs of what we would understand as plate tectonics. So she did a lot of work, and she was universally regarded as a fun and fiery and feisty person. So that makes me love her even more.
And Gemma, in our last 20, 30 seconds, anyone else you want to give a shout-out to from your list?
Oh, my gosh. There are so many people. Especially huge, huge thanks to those scientists to bring their work and the work of others to the public eye. You know, there are so many stars in science, the well-knowns like Neil deGrasse Tyson, Richard Dawkins, Jane Goodall, Stephen Jay Gould, but also there are so many other scientists up and coming like Carl Hart and Emily Grassley, people who are on YouTube and podcasting and really sharing the next generation of scientific achievements with the world, and they do a great job.
Gemma, thanks so much for being with us today. It's been fun.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha, talking about their feature, Science Heroes, Heroes of Science, the big names, sure, and also a lot of unsung heroes. You can keep sharing your contributions, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page and see what some other people have to say as well. Who stands out for you in the world of science, famous or otherwise? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Among the sounds you don't expect to hear on an airplane, how about this one?
That's the sound of saxophonist Kenny G serenading his fellow passengers this week on a Delta flight.
Apparently, the flight staff had raised donations from passengers for the nonprofit Relay for Life, an American Cancer Society fundraiser. This is something they do on the plane. But this time, they had Kenny G, I guess, as a passenger, and by promising an impromptu, you know, performance, if they broke $1,000, they actually raised twice that amount. Kenny G, Mr. G, I guess, kept up his part of the bargain and walked up the aisle playing a little show.
To say that video is a lot different than the other videos from airplanes we've been hearing recently. So an impromptu concert on an airplane makes you think, well, who would I love to have on an airplane and get a free concert for? Well, with some charity.
Well, I don't know. That's a tough one. But I got to imagine an airline executive here. Oh, a passenger video from our flight went viral. I mean, that's like a panic attack cause right there.
Then you go, oh, it's Kenny G.
Very benign performance there. I mean, you know, people think he's kind of schmarmy, the music. I've seen him play. I'm a saxophonist. Not my kind of music. Very, very talented performer, though. So
he sounded pretty great on that. Yeah, I'm assuming unedited, unfiltered recording.
Through a cell phone recording, yeah.
Exactly.
We'll leave you with a little more Kenny G to soothe you on this Monday afternoon here on Central Time.